This week on Writers, Inc.
With every book, it's always your first time in some way. And I think it's the funny thing about being a writer that you have that delusion of like, this time I know exactly what I'm doing. Like this time. And then you're like, no, I don't. Like what? It's just perpetually going back to that feeling of like, I don't know what I'm doing. And then remembering that, oh, right, this is part of it.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
Patrick O'Donnell.
J.P. Reinflesh.
Kevin Tomlinson.
And this is J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I'm like combing through the news trying to find something to talk about. And there's literally, like, I've got tons of stuff going on, which I kind of shared some of it with you guys yesterday, but I can't talk about any of it publicly. So, but what I did want to mention is this ITW town hall that we had the other day on our favorite topic, AI. We interviewed a copyright attorney. Yeah, take a shot. Everybody gets
take a shot.
Your glass out. We interviewed a copyright attorney. And I really think, especially after hearing this guy, a lot of this is going to come down to copyright. You know, because the gist of it is, you know, if you read the actual copyright law here in the U.S., and it's different everywhere. So like this is, you know, a complete, you know, cluster F if you go outside the country. But here in the U.S., in order to obtain a copyright, the text has to be written by a human. They actually use that language in there. So that would have to be changed. And it would take like an act of God to actually change something in the copyright language. It's not an easy thing to do. So if you were to actually use, from what this guy said, if you use AI to generate a portion of your text, when you file for your copyright, you actually have to identify, you know, what portions were written by the AI, what was written by the human, which means you basically own, let's say, 90% of your copyright. 10% is not copyrightable because it's written by an AI, or 80-20 or whatever the breakdown is. But the second you skew from 100% being human, it creates a ton of problems. And like he pointed this out, I didn't even think about it, but like in my actual contract, my publishing contracts, it stipulates that I'm 100% owner of the content that they're publishing on my behalf. You know, so I immediately wouldn't be able to submit that. I checked on a couple different sites where you can upload text, like Amazon, stuff like that. They do ask if you own the copyright. Nobody seems to ask for the actual registration statement for it. But I've got a feeling like that's where a lot of this is really going to play out, because, you know, if let's say Amazon just decides one day that, you know, if you don't own 100% of the copyright, it can't be on our site anymore. You know, you might have 5-6 books up there where you used AI to help you out, and, you know, they may have to come down. And a lot of these companies seem to be using, you know, there's tons of tech coming out to basically identify AI content, which is the other half of this. And the funny thing is they use AI in order to find the AI. You know, they rely on GPT-3, GPT-4 or whatever. But they're very accurate. So if you drop a paragraph of text in there that you wrote yourself, it's going to give you, you know, 0.001% is AI. It's, you know, some ridiculously small number. Anything actually coming out of the AI, it, you know, it's 60, 70, 80%. Because it's literally asking itself, did I write this? You know, so it can tell. So, you know, the Copyright Office, you know, a lot of these websites, I think they're going to start defaulting, I think, to this software. So they're going to be able to find it. So from my standpoint, I'm staying away until this all plays out. I don't know about you guys, but I don't even have it on my screen anymore.
No, I mean, I think that's the takeaway is don't use the AI right now because it's just too much of a risk.
Yep.
I'm not. I have no intention of using the AI to write anything for me, but I feel like there's just too many question marks anyway. You know, I mean, okay, the AI is going to scan, and it's, unless it's keeping a record of what it wrote and comparing it against it, there's nothing that it could use against you. Like, if I say I wrote that, how are you going to prove I didn't? And that's what it is really going to come down to is, you know, I guess if they've got automated flags and things, this will become another nightmare for everybody is what I'm saying. Amazon is going to make this a nightmare for everybody because Amazon just puts in the bare minimum to take care of problems like this. So if you get flagged, whether you used AI or not, they're going to be able to leverage that to use it as an excuse to not publish your book. That's what I see coming. Uncle Kevin's predictions.
Wise words, Uncle Kevin.
Yeah. I mean, the way the software works, you know, it basically identifies a percentage, you know, so all these companies, you know, so if Amazon decides that they're going to set a threshold, they're going to say if it's, you know, 30% or higher, we're not going to allow it or we're going to red flag it or whatever. And then it's going to be up to you as the author to prove that they're wrong. Or, you know, maybe
how do you do that?
You don't. That's the thing. So like,
right.
But like I have noticed in playing with these various, you know, the various software programs that, you know, if you put in text that you actually wrote yourself, you know, they're less than 1%, you know, so like the only real safeguard is to actually write the text yourself. You know, it's a weird problem. I mean, because like for me personally, like I write because I love to write, you know, like I've been doing this for years. I was doing it for much longer, way before people started paying me to do it. And I will continue, you know, if people stop paying me, I will continue to write every single day. So the real problem that, you know, is going to come out of all this are those, you know, the people that are trying to game the system, the ones that want to write a book in 5 minutes and put it up on Amazon to make a little extra cash, that have no interest in the actual craft. They just want to make some money. Those are the ones who are going to, you know, really gum up the works. And they're the ones that these various companies and entities are going to have to try to filter out. And Amazon will have to filter it out because, you know, at some point people are going to be able to throw up a book a minute, a book every 5 minutes, whatever it is. And even Amazon, their servers are not going to be able to handle that kind of data coming in. They're going to need some type of safeguard in place to protect against it. So crazy stuff. But if you want to listen to it, we'll put another link in the show notes. It's about an hour or so long. Basically, me and Adam Handy just talking to a copyright attorney. Interesting stuff. JP, what's in the news?
All right. So last week or a couple weeks ago, we talked about a Texas County library bringing books back in after they were removed. There's an update to that story, and the County Commission's Court is meeting today as we're recording, April 13th, to discuss the possibility of closing that library. So I know that the American Library Association and the Unite Against Book Bans are working together with the library to support those at-risk workers, etc. But I felt like this was an important update just to talk about because this situation is not a self-contained issue. We continue to see legislators banning books and targeting libraries. I know that there's a budget that was passed in Missouri that has completely defunded public libraries. So I think that this is important to have on our radar as authors because I think that we can be voices and places of support for public libraries, for bookstores. So I think it's important for us to know.
You know, it makes me think of Prohibition and how well outlawing alcohol actually stopped the use of alcohol. Like people kept drinking like the next day. It didn't change anything. It just, you know, what's going to happen here is those books will move to another location. You know, there's always going to be access. I think this is the wrong way to approach the problem.
It's the wrong way.
Yeah. I don't know what the right answer is. You know, banning the content isn't going to change anything. I think, you know, again, I think we need to drill down to our own personal level. If we want to ban it in our own house, you know, if we don't want our kids to look at something until they're a certain age, whatever, let's do that at the parental level. I don't need Senator, you know, this guy, that guy, whoever to make these decisions.
So is there going to be book speakeasies? Is that what's going to happen?
Yeah, that book speakeasies. We're going to start one covering some banned books.
Very good. You have to have a secret knock.
Every time we mention AI,
and,
you take a shot. That's it.
There we go.
I'm going to start the ban van, you know, just drive from county to county with my van full of banned books.
I think really, though, when we start talking about like defunding public libraries, like that impacts such a large group of people who would otherwise not have access to books. Yeah. And so it's just maddening to me to continue to hear this stuff.
What makes me sad is that this is the my neighbor county here in Texas. Where I'm in Williamson County. This is like right next to us. Is my in-laws live in this county.
So this is your fault. You're in that front row raising your hand.
We're going to blame Kevin. We're going to blame Kevin's in-laws for all of this.
Honestly, like here, like, you know, like we've got a very small library here on the island where I live, and there's 900 residents. So like, you know, funding is a huge deal here. Like I know exactly what the dollar amount going to the library is. I know what going to the school is, all that kind of stuff. We would raise the money ourselves. I think if they were to actually try to shut the library down, if they cut off funding, we would find some way to augment that income. You know, if we want, and again, like I may not like the content that's in there, but I like the fact that it is allowed to be in there and I don't want to see that go away.
Exactly. So next up in the news, Amazon is closing their UK-based online shop, Book Depository. So this is closing down the 26th of April of this year after almost two decades of being open in business. So I know that Book Depository was founded in 2004 by a former Amazon employee, and Amazon has been in the process of slashing thousands of jobs this year. So it looks like this is another one of those things that they're getting rid of this year.
I don't even know what this is. Have you guys ever heard of this before?
Never.
I've heard of it.
I don't know.
So when you use like Ingram Spark, if you're doing self-publishing, this is one of the locations that your book can show up in. It's probably the same for Draft to Digital. I just haven't used it for that. But this
I've
is just
used
another
it, but
place.
Not known it. So there you go.
Because Amazon is great at trying new things, and then they're horrible at actually telling anybody that they're trying new things. You know, we had a store not too far from here. It was, I think it was called Four and Up, and it was basically Amazon books that had, you know, a rating of four or better. And it didn't matter who the publisher was. If it had a good rating, you know, you could typically find it in there. It was a great store. I loved going in there, but like nobody knew about it. I've been in one of their grocery stores where you don't have to check out. You basically just load up your cart and walk right out the front door, and somehow they know exactly what you took with you. Fantastic stuff, but like you don't see a whole lot of that in the press. Like they really need to get better at the marketing side of this. They're great at certain things, but horrible at, you know, some of these business ventures.
Definitely. Last in the news, James Patterson lashes out at the New York Times bestseller list. So our good friend James is frustrated with his latest nonfiction book. It didn't make the New York Times bestseller, but he had all the data that showed him that it was outselling most of those authors that were being featured through the book scan data. We do know that New York Times bestseller list is curated. It's not driven by raw sales. And the disappearance of that US Today bestseller list is kind of a blow because of this. So I know you have some more information on this if you'd like to share.
Not really. I haven't talked to Jim since this came out. I think Jim might need to write a couple of more books just to keep himself busy so that he's not focused on some of these other things. It seems like he's got free time. Like, I don't know how you write 30 books a year and still have free time. But he's doing us a huge favor with this. The New York Times list has been this, you know, crazy black hole. Nobody really knows quite how the books get on there. I can tell you years ago, the New York Times would send out a list, you know, once a week to bookstores, and they would say, these are the, you know, the books we feel will be on the list next week. And they would list, you know, 5 or 10 or whatever they felt was going to be there. And you had the ability to write something in as a bookstore owner. You could pencil in a name. That process went online, but they ignore a ton of stuff. They ignore Amazon sales. You know, like I know Dean Koontz pretty well, and he's on Thomas and Mercer now. You know, he topped the New York Times bestseller list literally with every title for most of his career, at least the latter half of it. The second he went to Thomas and Mercer, it's total crickets on the New York Times list. They don't count any of those. But we know, I mean, you can tell just by looking at the charts, he is selling an insane number of books, you know, but they don't count it. From my standpoint with Forsaken, I ran into this. I had a week where I sold a little over 14,000 copies, which was enough to clinch like maybe the top 10, you know, 11, 12, somewhere in that range on the New York Times list for that particular week. You can pull the book stat, you know, that's the stats. You can see what everybody is selling at. So I knew where I should have been, but they didn't count it, you know, as an indie author, because the bulk of those sales came from Amazon. The USA Today list, in my opinion, was the best one because it just relied strictly on 100% sales, which is, you know, if we're creating a bestseller list, that's what it should be. In Jim's case, you know, like this was it's a fantastic book. It, you know, it's about cops. It's an inside, you know, interviews with cops and situations that they've been in. It's extremely well written. It's written by the same guy that Black Hawk Down was based on. He also wrote Walk in My Combat Boots, which is another one. I mean, he just, because he walked and he worked in that world, he's able to get inside the heads of these people. When he does an interview, like they can, you know, he can talk their language. So he pulls a lot of detail out. And, you know, when you read this one, the one about cops, not all the stories are good. Not all of them are bad. But it's true, you know, like, and it, I think it's an important thing for people to see and read because, you know, cops get a bad rap, you know, and they're out there doing a tough job, you know, and this gives you a nice insight into what their lives are really like. And it shouldn't be shut out, you know, for the reasons that it was.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder how relevant is the New York Times list at this point, though? Like, are readers really using this list to determine what they read next?
I think they do. You know, a lot of people open up that paper on Sunday morning. They look at the list and say, okay, that's what I'm going to read next. They walk into a Barnes and Noble, you know, and you know, they see that as being the popular books. That's what everybody else is reading. You know, like the New York Times is basically, you know, they're curating that list and you know, giving them something to work with that's manageable instead of the, you know, 10,000 titles that came out that particular week. You're looking at 15. But I, you know, I think it needs to be based on something other than what it is. It shouldn't be, you know, based on human opinions. It should be based strictly on the stats. You know, this is what's selling. This is what's not selling.
I agree. And, you know, they exclude self-publishing.
Yeah, that's it, right? When indie authors are going, oh, I want to hit the New York Times bestsellers list, is that a reasonable goal? Because as we said, it is a curated list. It's not a sales number list. So as an indie author, I mean, you might have a 1% chance to hit that list, but it's really difficult to hit the New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, you actually, as far as I know, you can't get on the New York Times list as an indie author now.
Yeah, no, you can. It's just it's very difficult as an indie just because of the places that indies tend to sell. You know, they're selling at Barnes & Noble online. They're selling, you know, primarily at Amazon. And the New York Times list is curated mainly from bookstores, you know, not necessarily even Barnes & Noble, but the independent bookstores, you know, have a huge say in it. And one of the factors that they currently use is the diversification of your sales numbers. So you have to have a large percentage coming from indie stores, a large percentage coming from box stores, large percentage coming from this, coming from that. It needs to be a mix of everything. And most indie authors just don't target that wide. They don't cast that wide of a net.
Yeah.
You know, I think Dean Koontz is probably the biggest example of that because he's technically not an indie author. He's on Thomas & Mercer. You know, you can find his books in bookstores because of who he is. But he's still not able to make the list right now at this point, even though he's selling in all those different venues, just not at a, you know, the ratio that they agree with.
Right. Do you think that has to do with booksellers? Because, you know, they get these huge catalogs from different publishers, the big four or five or whatever it is, you know, 700-800 books every 3 months they have to go to and decide what to buy for their store. So, I mean, when you're already having that much competition just with trad titles, it's got to be really difficult for indies to diversify into bookstores, I would imagine.
Well, it's even beyond the catalogs. They, you know, the publishers actually hire people to walk into the stores, you know, to basically, you know, here's our catalog, but in the catalog, these are the five you really want to look at. You know, so like, it, you know, indie authors can't even get in that catalog, let alone get on the list of, you know, that's being mentioned when they come through that door. Right. So it's a difficult thing to compete with. I mean, you really need sales numbers behind you. You know, as an indie author, if you're selling big enough numbers, the stores will carry you. Get your fans to walk into a store and request you. The more often that happens, the more often you're going to see your title start to show up there. You know, you kind of have to back the word a little bit.
This episode is brought to you by MasterWriter. MasterWriter is a powerful collection of writing tools and references assembled in one easy-to-use program. Included are word families, phrases, synonyms, rhymes, definitions, figures of speech, pop culture, a searchable Bible of intensifiers, and a unique collection of intense descriptive words. Why struggle to find the right word when you can have all the possibilities in an instant? While a computer can't compete with the mind and imagination of a writer, the mind can't compete with the word choices that Master Writer will give you in an instant. When the two work together, great things happen. Check it out today at masterwriter.com.
Okay, so JD, who's up this week?
Oh, this one's going to be fun. We've got Carolyn Kepnes coming on. She's the author of the books behind the Netflix show You, and her latest title is called For You and Only You and releases April 25th. So here she is, Carolyn Kepnes.
So you have a new book out, For You and Only You, the fourth book in the Joe Goldberg series.
Yes.
Yeah.
Something like I can't the math, but the way each one is like around 400 pages. And then, you know, with writing, it's all rewriting. So there are a whole, like, it's that moment of like, oh my God, I have written so much about this guy, like so much, because there's all that gets cut and redone. And yeah.
Yeah. And it's always been kind of very literary focused, but this book is really examining a lot about the writing process, what it means to be a writer. There are a lot of contemporary writers in it.
Yeah, it felt like, you know, it started with the pandemic and I was in, you know, home, like we're all in our own situation. And I was starting to think, like, people were like, how would Joe handle this? And I'm like, oh my God, he'd be one of those people who's like making the sourdough, getting it all done, kidnapping someone and getting away with it and writing his own book. So that I went with that of feeling like part of his survival is his like amazing selfishness, which sometimes a lot of us could stand to be a little bit more that way of like getting our business done. And I went from there of thinking about like how there's when he says that the reader becomes a writer, I feel like that's a lot of his way of thinking, that like he's making that divorce in his head. Like a well-adjusted person understands that, like, no, the reader, you're a reader, you're a writer. Like there's not an end point, you know? And I, as I went there and put him in the room with those writers and felt them all come to life, I just, it was incredible. Like it was a very loud, like intense experience of, yes, the writing those workshops was a light of my life. I hope they are fun to read.
Yeah, they were. And but I kept thinking, you know, like, how do you write about this without getting into your own head and messing up your own writing? What was that?
I don't know. And I mean, that's where I'm like, you read the book, like maybe you can't. Like it got to that point. Yeah, where, and also keeping all of their books in my head and kind of like, right, like going off and like, especially Sarah Beth, like when I was born, my parents, my mom was out of it and my dad named me Sarah. So it's this like joke in my family that my middle name is Beth, that I'm like Sarah Beth. So I just felt very close to her for a lot of reasons. And I loved coming up with her titles. And then I'm like kind of spinning off and starting to write one of those and then getting back into my head and then into Joe's head. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I feel like it's long. There's a lot there. I had fun. I hope you like read it with this, like not like that you have to read it all in a day thing. Cause I feel like it's a busy, loud crowd in there, you know?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And Joe's book title was perfect. That was the perfect book title for him.
Yes, that felt right. And yeah.
Yeah. And one of your characters has real literal imposter syndrome.
Yes. I mean, I think, again, like there was a lot of online time and I loved seeing everyone like in the, like putting them all like Joe bringing out the worst in everyone and wanting to see the worst in everyone. The way that like if someone gives you a taste, it's pretty fucking appealing. And then suddenly you're doing it more and more. And that's how I felt it, of like that even being around Joe is bringing out everything that he wants to think of these people as in them. And that's the magic to me of a person who like is always in the right, you know, and who just like if someone expects bad from you, then it's easier to do bad. It's all kind of set up there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really interesting for me as a writer just reading it, because there are a lot of questions that I've had, like, you know, in my own process. And I think we all go through this when we're writing. So you have a writer that loves to write and another character who loves to have written.
Yes.
And it just got me thinking about that. I'm curious, do you love one more than the other? Do you love both?
I don't know. I'm curious about you too. Like, I feel like I love to write too much and it's not always the best way to be, because it's that you like just spewing it out on and on and on without necessarily knowing what it is. And then like 50 pages, like, oh, now's when I'm supposed to start writing. Like, I think thinking is so important before writing, but writing is so fun once you're in it, it's all flowing and it all can look like something and kind of trick you into thinking like, hey, that's, you know, that's a scene that makes sense. And then a week later, like, oh no, like that was fun to do, but it doesn't mean that it's it. Like, what about you? Are you a love writer or a love having written?
I love the process, but I also, of course, love when something's finished. But I was just thinking about, can you be a successful writer if you don't love the process? So that was something that I was pondering this week.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. And that's where, like, I with Wonder's book, I felt like it is kind of going against the grain of everything that's like in our ether, as far as like, let people into your process, do it, get it done, like present yourself, show yourself, like that. It's all changed so much. Like I was in my 20s in the 90s, when my idea of a writer was someone where you didn't even know what they look like, and or what section it was in the bookstore, because I found it in some bin on the street and felt special that no one knew about it but me. And now we just live in a very different world. So I loved the idea of this woman who's like loves to be writing this book privately, secretly, and Joe kind of pushing against that. And then, of course, the minute she kind of embraces that idea of like, oh, it could be nice to be, to have written and to be out there, he's like, well, that makes you a phony.
That is really interesting. Cause yeah, I think, you know, there used to be this real perception of a writer as being the solitary person alone in the woods in their cabin, typing on their keyboard. And that's not the way it is anymore, especially with like social media and all these author communities. And it's not really such a solitary pursuit anymore.
Yeah. And that's where it was. I feel like Joe being someone who's so old school and rigid, like the same way in you, the way he was like collecting these typewriters, it's like he's going to hold on to that idea and be kind of disparaging of anyone who enjoys any sense of community, when really he's just like hurt because he thought that these people would all be his best friends. And it's like, dude, no, like they're not like you. They didn't, you know, they're not here because they murdered people and got away with it. Like, you know? And I think it's that outsider feeling. And that's where people connect with it, with him over the years. Like, it doesn't make you a murderer to sometimes feel like you don't speak the language or you can't get there. And that was what felt right in this book of like, his profound social awkwardness after the pandemic, when all of us, I think, are a little nuts. Like,
yeah, for sure. I love that. So in your book, one character says that when it comes to writing, praise is poison. Do you think that's true? Can praise put too much pressure on a writer?
I mean, I feel like I've had those moments when I was younger and like I would get a compliment and then run with it hardcore. Like I remember I did that thing in college where I had done something with a little art in it, you know, like a little poetry where like the indentation and someone said something nice about it. So then I do like a whole fucking like indentation art. Oh, look at it. You have to step back to read it. You know, and I feel like we all like that's part of growing as a writer. And it's the same way that like I still have this rejection letter from 17 magazine that was like a turning point in a good way because it was handwritten. It was, they named the story. She was so thoughtful. I could tell she read it. And it was like, you know, you're good at this. Like, I want to see what you do next. And it was like this moment of, oh, right. Like, no, criticism gives you purpose. Praise tells you, and it's all downhill from here on some level. And I feel like that's part of the human condition. Like, it's not just about writing, but I think that's also where it was fun to take Joe and put him in this position of being very aware that like, he's Joe. So he only wants this book to be out there if the whole world is like, oh my God, you're a genius. You're J.D. Salinger. You're the best thing ever. Also, your girlfriend is too. She's just as good as you. Everyone else is dead. It's like an exaggerated form of what all our modern culture, with everything being rated, discussed, like analyzed, graded, kind of puts in us a little bit. So I feel like there are moments of that where, yeah, praise can be poison. But it doesn't mean that it's bad. Like a little poison also makes you stronger.
That's true, right? Yeah. And it was very funny because he did want to be the J.D. Salinger, but maybe would have sold out to write some erotica or something too. I don't know. So you've had quite a lot of success. Do you ever feel pressure about having to do as well or better than your last book?
It's like that's the wonderful nightmare of like, And especially with this book where it was so much about writing, and it's my first time writing a fourth book in a series. Like it's like all with every book, it's always your first time in some way. And I think it's the funny thing about being a writer that you have that delusion of like, this time I know exactly what I'm doing. Like this time. And then you're like, no, I don't. Like what the, like, it's just perpetually going back to that feeling of like, I don't know what I'm doing. And then remembering that, oh, right, this is part of it. Like it's the discovery, it's the creativity. Like to me, like there are those pantsing days where you fly and you wind up somewhere you never expected. And oh my God, it's art and it's great. And then there are those plotting days where you get there and you're like, oh, that's great, but what the fuck? And I don't remember, yeah, what you asked, but I feel like,
Yeah, I was asking how do you deal with pressure, like when you've had success?
And then you have to like laugh, I guess, and feel like, well, the same way that like, do you know Gabino Iglesias? He's been like tweeting like 1-star reviews of books that just make me laugh. And remember that like everyone's going to hate some things. Everyone's going to love some things. It's all the first grade stuff you hear. Like the only person you can please is you, and work with yourself and try and learn from your mistakes and all that cheesy shit. And just like, put it on a pillow and stuff it in your head and go.
Yeah, right. For sure. So you just have fun. Is that how we deal with it?
I feel like, having the fun and then doing the work and like doing the ugly and the pretty. Do you know what I mean? It's like all creative processes, like whether you're getting a haircut or whatever it is, it's like some of it, it's painstaking and other parts are like, ooh. And yeah.
Yeah, we've all had those nervous haircuts, but it turns out okay in the end, like usually.
Right. When they're like, this isn't it. And you're like, no, this is it. Like, what are you doing? And
so one of the hard parts about writing is, you know, this elusive thing called voice. So I'm curious, how did your emergency throat surgery and the resulting enforced silence help you develop your writer voice?
Oh my gosh. Well, it had been a very talky time. Like, I had gone through personal loss of losing my father. And it's going to sound silly to say these things in the same sentence, but then I had also taken a leap of faith and made a short film, which was very, like, you know, a lot of talking, you know, that was one of those, oh, it'll cost a couple hundred dollars and take a month. And no, they don't. It doesn't work that way. So I was in this, like, place of retreat and communicating on a notepad where I kept noticing that the way that I talk, like, tone of voice is so important. And it was like this hyper version of what it's like to text. And I kept seeing smiley faces next to what I was writing. And I was like, it's part, like, woman disease of, like, the need to, like, I assure you, like, I'm not mean. I'm being, you know, making a joke. And that really made me aware of my own voice and kind of how we sound, like, how the way you sound in your own head. And that experience did prime me for Joe, because it was like, much as, like, he's always up to something. And of course, like, there's the action in the world. It was so much for me, the writing experiment of, like, can I get that feeling of when you catch yourself in your head, the way that you talk or the little things that stayed with you and come back to you that you don't always say out loud all the time? Like, can I get that feeling in there? And can I do it in this guy? And yeah, so that those notebooks, like, I would just look through them, see the smiley faces, see the bad handwriting where it was like, yeah, it's useless if no one knows what you're saying, you know, like, essentially you can't go out and drink and be mute and try and, like, talk to a friend.
That's so true. And yeah, the smiley faces, I always get it with the exclamation points. And then I get so mad at myself for using too many
And then on the other side of that, you see friends that are like, oh, I'm doing this thing. Like, I'm checking every email for smiley faces and exclamation points. It's like, oh, for fuck's sake, can we just forgive ourselves and, like, say, I feel weird when I don't put an exclamation point sometimes. I have no idea if the person on the receiving end feels that way, but, like.
Yeah, I do too. And then I get mad at myself and take them out. I'm like, I'm not just going to, like, excuse this with exclamation points. It's going out blunt.
Right. And it's funny. It's where, like, written communication, like, freaks me out. I refused to text for so long. Like, I was just against it. And then I was turning 30 and I had organized this birthday party and I had a few friends, but most people didn't show up. And there was a mix up with the bar. There was a private something going on, like a little problem. But then I was like, oh my God, is everyone angry at me? And it was like, no, all I heard from people was, I texted you, but you didn't write back because they didn't call. And then I joined the world of texting because I understood that, like, okay, this is a way of life now. Like, this is how it is. But it's the way that we have so much more communication where we're kind of responsible for things that happen naturally in a situation like this, where, like, in-person communication or face-to-face is, like, just so fundamentally different from the written word that can sound so different from what it means. And when we're so saturated by it, and it's how I communicate now, like, I'm a total hypocrite that way, that I went from, like, texting never to, like, why is that phone ringing? Like, but I feel like all those things build up in us and we're so unaware of how many little, like, different ways we have to mitigate and moderate and interpret and, you know, and cover and couch things and
yeah,
I keep up with, like, then when they're like, it's not cool to use a smiley face, like, oh, for fuck's sake, I don't know.
Right now it's like, I can't use emojis now. I mean, emojis make us old, apparently. I'm like, I don't know what to do now. It just looks so stark. I'm like, mm-hmm. Everyone's gonna think I'm mad at them, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah, and then you got to think about your language more, right? So
yeah, and then all of it is, like, the most common human thing. I feel like it all boils down to youth chasing, which every generation does. When then they're like, only old people use GIFs. I'm like, well, okay, then, like, this is getting old. Then I'll use my GIFs, whatever you call them. And
yeah, I still like those. I use them, like, daily. So that's tough. Nothing. I guess I'm old and I'll just have to accept it. So you said that at that time there was also, you were going through some things. And you've said elsewhere that Joe is kind of a cancer who will survive everything. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, when my dad was diagnosed with bladder cancer, and that was one of those experiences where, he didn't tell us for a while. You know, there was that day where my family was together, and my dad and my brother got in one elevator. My mom and I got in another. My mom and I are sobbing. Like, the news was bad. It was, like, that basic, this is stage 4 palliative, like, we're in separate elevators. We get down there. My dad and my brother are, like, laughing, talking. My mom and I are sobbing. And I'm like, oh my God, were we all just in the same room? And it was like two different approaches to handling emotions, life, and that kind of stayed with me. Like, what do you do? Like, Joe is the cancer in the sense that he's always going to survive. Like, when people will say, oh, is he someone going to kill him? I'm like, no, that's the point. That, like, you don't always know when you're up against cancer in human form, in this form, or sometimes you sense it, but you can't resist the challenge. So you go in there, but most of the time you probably don't know. Like, and that experience of like being so hyper aware of choosing how to interpret bad news, I feel like is so much of where Joe came from. Where with Joe, like on the one hand, he's a very positive thinker because everything bad, he's like, well, I can help you. I can help you make it good again. And it's almost as deluded as anyone battling cancer. And everyone's like, you got this, go do it. Like, well, no, you don't. Like, but how else, but would you rather go through the day? Like, yeah, having those moments. Sure, there are days of sad of like, you know, or you can enjoy that human spirit of there are miracles and at least I'm in the moment and this is all there is. And yeah.
Yeah. So that's really interesting because yeah, Joe is like, he's just the most hopeful person ever. He's always hopeful things are going to work out. But he is astute in some ways, but also his perceptions are so warped in some ways.
Yeah, it's part of that. Like one of my favorite movie scenes that stayed with me forever was Dumb and Dumber. I think really because I was in high school, it was like just so impressionable. And when she's, you know, when he's doing that thing with her and she's like one in a million or like not whatever she says. And he's like, so you're telling me there's a chance.
There's I'm a
like,
chance.
That, yes. Like, and we all know that, like, we like that character because we know that feeling of like not wanting to hear no. And then of course the mixed messages of like, what is romantic about that? What is healthy of like, we hear all the time, like in your career, like don't take no for an answer. Keep trying, go get them, go, 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 go. But now in relationships and in all things romance, it's like, unless you have a handwritten note that says yes, like, watch out, bitch. Like,
yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true. Yeah, I really like, you know, his attitudes about a lot of things. The social media and the gems and his attitude towards that. Do you think that writers need a social media presence or...
I think none of us know. I think it's there. Like, I like to see my friend's stuff and hear about books. Like, and I like that thing when you see a book cover and you become obsessed with it because you see it different places. Like right now for me, that's Yellowface. I see that cover. I'm like, I want that book. I want to touch it. It looks good. But I feel like it's there. It doesn't matter what I think, if I think we need it or we don't, because it's there. And that's yeah. What's so weird about it. Do you know what I mean? Like, for me, it's like, it's like the way that it used to be that the library closed and that was it. It was closed. The bookstore closed. Now the shit is open all the time. So even if you're like, I'm taking a break or I'm taking an active stance against it, it's still there. So
yeah.
And like some people are definitely better at it or like enjoy it. It's built for their personalities. They're good at expressing themselves that way. Other people, I feel like that's where it's just, you know, interesting.
Yeah. It can be such a distraction though, like when you're supposed to be doing other things. Have you ever struggled with that, keeping off of social media or games or?
Absolutely. That's what, like, I feel like I have to be my own mother, my own, like, put yourself in the corner. Like, you don't need to watch, like, I like watching those roller skating videos right now. So it's also weird the way it's such a, like, a fucking drug dealer, the way it knows what you like. So if I go on Instagram, it's like, here, it's all roller skating. Like, and it's just a moment that I'm in of like, I like the music, the movement, I can't roller skate. And I'm like, why did this is so cruel? And I'm like, in 100 years, they'll study what this did to us. Cause it would be easier to walk away if it didn't know exactly what I want. But then you know how it is, then whatever you're looking into, like it thinks that that's your thing. And that's what, sometimes that can be beneficial.
Yeah.
No, I don't want this. This was something I was looking up, like a charcuterie board or whatever, you know.
Or it's just like, oh, that looked interesting one time. And now that's my whole feed. I get a lot of dogs, which I actually don't mind the dogs. The dogs are pretty good.
Yeah, that's they probably lower the blood pressure and all that. How do you manage it?
Not well. I wish I did better. I'm very distractible. So, but I do set writing time. So that usually helps. I'm like, no, this is writing time. I tell them.
Yeah.
It's I'm like, in the dungeon. You gotta go.
It's reminding yourself too of like, how much better is it going to feel if I did those hours and did this? And then, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Letting it be dessert.
But yeah. So speaking of weird things, I want to know, what's the strangest thing you've ever looked up as a writer? And did you use a private browser?
I never I just Google. I'm like, I'll assume that like I won't be suspected. Like, there was that story last year, the woman who did do it, like kill someone after all the Googling. Well, I went to, it's not a lookup thing, but last year at one point with this book, with Wonder working at a Dunkin' Donuts, they have those ovens, and I had it in my head that she, you know. So going to this Dunkin' Donuts with my brother, and the guy was so friendly, and it was pretty quiet. And I'm like, I'm a writer. Can I come back there and just kind of look around a little? And he's like, sure, come on back. And nicest man in the world. I'm like, can I see the oven? He's like, sure, here's the oven. I'm like, can I see if I can fit in there? And my brother's like, no. The guy's like, no, no. And then I'm like, no. And I knew that I could fit in there. It didn't even happen in the book. It didn't go in it. But that's what I feel like the internet also can do to you when you're used to looking up weird things and it's just you. So like, you're looking at this knife, you're looking at, you know, burying places, and you get, so you know that you're, that it's research, but you bring that into the world a little and are like, oh, right. Like, this nice man is already like letting me in. And now I'm asking if I can go in the oven. Just no. Like, so yeah, like mostly, yeah, the usual, like in on the computer, the burying bodies. And I like those rabbit holes of like finding something, you know, and then you just fall. And
yeah, you can get sucked down those rabbit holes.
Idaho has taken up suddenly days of your life. And yeah.
Have you found it? What's the weirdest spot you've ever found that someone has buried someone?
Oh, well, I mean, it was where I grew up. It's not the weirdest, but it was, you know, it's that thing if it's close to home. Yeah. There was a motel where the guy buried his wife at the motel in the front yard. And that was pretty bold, you know, like when they do it at home, like I guess in Marley and Me, they bury the pet at home because it's like, yeah, it's your pet. It's your family. It's love. That's what you do. But when you kill someone in your family and bury them in the home, it's like, isn't that when you exactly when you take them to the woods? Or
yeah, like that is pretty bold, and you're probably going to get caught if you bury someone in your yard. So yeah. Pro tip, don't bury and someone then, in your yard.
No matter what you believe, would you want that reminder? Like, wouldn't you want them kind of away? Like,
yeah.
Like, I like in our house, my cat is in the backyard. I'm like, Cookie was the best. So it's nice that to think of her spirit out there, if that's a thing that exists. But if someone like broke it and tried to kill me, I wouldn't want them in the backyard. Like, no.
No, 100% not. They need to go far away. So I want to ask about the references in your book. You've got a lot of like nostalgic and pop culture references. Tell me a bit more about that. How you use that? Do you think it's kind of a shorthand to connect with readers? What do you love about that?
That's one of those things like, that it started with that first book, and it was always in short stories that like I finally came to terms with myself that like, whatever, this is just how I write. And whenever I tried to consciously not do that, it was very like, it was raining that night, like I'd become someone else. And I'm like, it's not intentional. It's not like I want it to be this way, but it's kind of like accepting the way your brain works. And especially then with these books that like, this is how it is. And then trying to like have fun with it or see where it goes. So yeah, it's overwhelming because like in the beginning, like I remember being asked like after one book, like, did you have a list of things? I'm like, no, it was so spontaneous of like, as I'm writing that book. But then once in, I feel like in any series, like once your book is out there and it's established and this you've set up, this is like how this person thinks, how they operate, suddenly it comes. So it's impossible not to like go through the world of like, how would Joe think about that? Would he know about that? Would I, you know what I mean? Like, and kind of deciding what he would think about things. And yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. Cause I really enjoy it. Cause it is like a bit nostalgic, you know, and I'm like, yeah. Oh, I love this. I forgot about this. And it makes a nice warm feeling in a book. That's not a warm feeling book, I guess.
I mean, I hope so. Yeah. Because that I feel like I also think it makes him, for me, it helps make him human.
Yeah.
Or like, it's just this hopefully like not in your face, but like reminder that like, he's, you know, watching shit and liking it. Like the White Lotus thing in the book. Like I loved that, you know, I loved the second season too, but that first season I loved so much. And it was like, oh yeah, he, you know, of course he wants to know how it ends if he thinks his life is ending. Like,
so I want to know, what's your take on profanity in fiction? How much is too much?
That's another thing of like, not, I know I, I don't know, right? Depends on the thing, right? Like the way in some books, like it works, it doesn't, like I'm not where it's just a part of the flow and it's how they talk. And then in other books, when there's a sudden fuck, it's like, oh, fuck, like it'll pull you right out. And that's where in these books, like I don't, you know, it's another, like for me, I'm obsessed with the language and like Santino Fontana, who does the audiobooks. I kind of blame him for that because I've always like loved reading things out loud and the way they flow. So often for me, the profanity is part of the like, dun, 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 like the little symphony. Yeah. And hearing him do things makes me want everything to sound really, you know, to flow. But then I'm like, wow, there are probably like 8 million fucks in this book. And like,
is that ever like in the industry, publishers, do they care about that? Or is that, you've never gotten any pushback on that?
I haven't on these, but I feel like that's also, You was my first book. So it was like, one, I feel like it was that going in established, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know, then it is weird that way about like how, to me, with writing a series where like, because I'm writing another thing right now and I feel very aware when there's an F word in there to the point where I say F word instead of saying it. Do you know what I mean? And yeah, I feel like, yeah, when there's one in this thing, I'm like, ooh. So yeah, I feel like each work has its own little set of rules. And
that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Okay. So as we're coming to a close, I have one final question. If you could offer one piece of advice to new and aspiring writers, what would it be?
Do it. Just do it. Just like, do it's it. The Nike shit of it. Like, don't talk about it. Even talk about it. Do it your way and stop looking for the answer, because the experiment is the only way to find your answer. When you hear writing advice, apply it to yourself. If someone you love says that they work in a coffee shop, go to a coffee shop, sit there for 2 hours, see what happens.
This episode is brought to you by our amazing sponsor, Later Press. Later Press is a platform built to help authors declare independence. It lets authors create digital books and sell them directly to readers through a branded website. Later Press is free to publish on and doesn't take any commission on direct sales. It's one of the most effective ways readers can directly support authors they love. Get started today at laterpress.com.
So do you have a preference for the writing process or having written, or do you like both?
I like writing. I write every single day, 365 Rebel. Days a year, sometimes 367. And it's just it's cathartic for me. I'm not good at math is what I'm trying to say here. But I come to the page every day, and I start with like journaling and things like that, you know, and that's my like warm up and self-therapy and that sort of thing. But you know, the fiction is has been a part of my life for a very long time. I write a lot of nonfiction. Basically any opportunity I have to write is a joy for me.
Yeah, I get all twitchy if I don't do it. I'm like a druggie that hasn't gotten its fix. So I have to get into charity. I skip Sundays, but mainly to hang out with the family. But otherwise, you know, birthdays, you know, crap, I even wrote on my wedding day. Don't tell my wife, but, you know, it's one of those things. It calms me down. It makes it, you know, helps keep me sane, or as sane as I am on a daily basis.
Does your family notice when
I think they do.
Written?
My daughter is more than once like put me in my office and said, put, you know, like pushed me into my chair and said, make some words, Dada, and like walked away. So maybe she's onto something.
Like for me, it all depends on deadlines. You know, I'm writing for somebody right now, and it's a different universe when it's like, okay, you have to be done by X date, and we rapid release. So there is no, I don't feel like it today. It's no, you're going to do it today. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, it's like homework. You know, it's like if you wait till the last minute, which I always did in school, you know, you're going to get buried in that avalanche of work that is going to come like snowing upon you. But it's also, I think you're writing, it doesn't necessarily have to be keyboard or pen to paper, where it's like, okay, I'll be on my motorcycle. And it's like, okay, I was thinking really hard the last couple of days, how I'm going to end this current book that I'm writing. And sure enough, it just kind of popped in my head but you never stop thinking about that stuff. I don't think it's always going on.
Yeah, for sure. I thought it was really interesting how she found her writer's voice when she couldn't talk and was realizing how she was writing to other people and, you know, how she had to help that with exclamation points or smiley faces. And it was like, oh, that really made her think a lot about voice. Have you ever had any real life experiences that have helped you develop your writer's voice?
First of all, I can't picture her not talking. Yeah. That woman has, she has so much energy. Not like I wanted to hand her a cup of decaf.
I'd like to apologize to our guest.
No, I mean, like, I think she would feel like she was going to explode. You know, somebody like that, that is so used to communicating, that communicates, you know, like, it's, yeah, you know, like, I could picture the hand gestures going on and everything as she was speaking. And like, to all of a sudden muzzle somebody like that must have been brutal for her to go through. My writer voice is, it's funny, and I see this when I mentor students. You know, like most writers, when they first start off, they sound like whatever it is they're reading, or they do their best to sound like it. So if they're reading a ton of Stephen King, you know, they're trying to write like Stephen King, and it's never anywhere near that good. But you know, they're kind of mimicking that. You know, sooner or later, especially with mentoring students, a lot of times I'll tell them to just write something in first person, and treat it, you know, like, you know, Kevin, you had mentioned journaling it, you know, like it's, you know, that's a great way to find your voice, because it's your voice in that journal. You know, I think even there though, people try to clean it up. They want to sound a little bit smarter than they actually are, a little bit different, or they want to, you know, they want to be J.D. Salinger, you know, in their journal. And like, you have to let that go.
J.D. Barker.
Yeah, J.D. Barker. You got to let that go. You got to just let it be you. And I think once that clicks in your head, then you can write not only that, but you can write, you know, other characters, other voices. It all kind of comes together.
I don't think it's a problem though that they try to sound smarter or try to, you know, I mean, I think that's how you push your limits and figure out what works and what doesn't. And, you know, the real key there though is, you know, you don't typically share your journal writing with someone else. So you don't get that feedback, whether it's, you know, direct feedback or just sort of intrinsic or whatever. So I think it, you know, if you want to improve your voice, you really should be writing something that other people are going to read. That's why I think something like blogging is probably a good platform for most beginning writers. Just take the idea that you're going to make money off the blog out of it, because you might, but you probably won't. But if you can just build up an audience that comes back regularly to see what you wrote, you'll really improve over time.
Yeah.
And I think you start, or you should get better and better at that. And you find your voice the more books you write. Well, the more you write, period. You should, and I think you should, you know, find that voice. And, you know, it's just it happens quicker than others. So, you know, sometimes you have to have a little patience, and, you know, your first book is not going to be the best.
Well, here's my question. Do you write in a different voice depending on the type of writing you're doing? So like, you know, if you send a text message or an email, or, you know, is it all very different?
Email for me is, yes, my safe space. That's like the one place where I don't care about commas. I don't care about punctuation or, you know, proper grammar. I just, yeah, kind of throw it out there. Text messages, I'm still, you know, I get tons of, you know, clip sentences and texts from different people, abbreviations, stuff like that. I can't go there. Like I need to actually put a complete, yeah, sentence down when I text somebody. But I'm finding that's changing too. You know, I'm kind of falling into that world.
You know, it's funny.
Text
you mentioned
dialogue. I text in dialogue.
You know, it's, yeah, funny you mentioned that, because I remember when texting was just starting. I'm old, and I had young cops that were like in their 20s and 30s, and they're texting me, and I'm like, no, call me. And they're like, no, Sarge, we text. And then I'm like, all right, fine, I'll text now, because they were texting. You know, that's,
he wants to talk on the phone like a sociopath.
Yeah, I know, that's crazy talk. So let me ask you this to the group, Hive. Do you ever think a book is going to get written like the way you text, you know, with, you know, abbreviations and all that?
Oh, they've done that.
Oh, that, yeah, they have. Yeah. Yeah.
I hope, yeah, I don't. Yeah.
Are you going to?
So much so that Vellum actually has now a formatting for like text messaging and that sort of thing. Like, you could do an entire book in that format now. So, yeah, that's been done.
Nuts. Yeah.
I don't want to read it.
No.
But that's been done.
I think that could be fun. You know, it'd be a challenge.
There's even, what was it? I think it's Wattpad has a subsect of Wattpad that you read it as if it's text messages being sent to each other. So like, it's as if you're reading it, quote unquote, yes, real time.
Yeah.
So even like an interactive, yes, platform already exists with that.
Well,
so
think about a book like Dracula, like that was actually written, you know, it's letters and things like that going back and forth. So if, you know, Bram decided to write Dracula today, it probably would be text messages.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. With emojis. Cool.
With emojis.
New,
yeah,
book for you, heart emojis.
Little blood drop.
Fangs. Droplets of blood. Yeah.
Have any of you ever
climbed, but no crosses.
Any of you ever climbed into an oven to see if you fit, just for a book?
No, but I was like, oh my goodness, what's going on with the research? I am curious. So what's like the strangest thing you've ever looked up as a writer, or the strangest thing you've ever done in the real world?
Oh.
You got anything good?
I've Googled, you know, like looked under the kitchen sink at the chemicals there and like Googled like, what can I make of this kind of thing? Try to figure out what I can combine to make poisonous gas or do this or do that. There's a famous story with Stephen King where he handcuffed Joe when he was a kid to a bed when he was writing, I guess it was Gerald's Game. And he asked Joe, like, can you flip over the back of the bed and push the bed forward across the room? And then his wife, I guess, walked in and caught them all doing this and kind of shut that project down. But, you know, I think you have to try some of these things, right? Because especially if it seems very over the top, you want to see if it's going to work. I've never climbed into an oven. But I've done, you know, I could probably make a bomb out of half the stuff I've got under the kitchen sink.
I've Googled that too, which, you know, it's probably not smart, but I have. I don't know if we talked about this, but my husband's an attorney for the U.S. Army. So I'm looking up something and he comes up behind me one day and he's like, what are you Googling? I'm like, how to build a thermobaric bomb. He's like, don't do that. I like almost gave him a heart attack. Thinks ICE is coming to the door.
So I have to tell you, I will often, after a series of Googling things for my books, I'll usually Google like a note to the, you know, the NSA or something like, dear NSA, I am an author and I am just doing research. I figure if they scan my history, I've got something somewhere.
Yeah, I think
I don't know if I told JP this, but this week I put in a Google search that the internet returned the suicide hotline for me. And I was like, I get stuff like that, honestly.
Yeah, I get those a lot, actually.
I think we're giving the government too much credit, you know, expecting somebody to show up on our doorstep. Like, if you actually walk into an FBI office or a CIA office, like, they're running, you know, PCs from like 1992, they're on Windows 95. You know, they're not piecing together anything that you're doing at home. You know, maybe NSA at that level on, you know, two machines in a back room somewhere. But they're not coming after us. I mean, some of my Google searches, if they haven't shown up on my doorstep yet, nobody's coming.
Well, did you hear, I mean, when you remember when they had that bombing thing, someone used a pressure cooker at the Boston Marathon, and a woman ordered a pressure cooker like that morning or something, and they showed up at her house to find out, why did you order a pressure cooker? Are you the bomber? And, you know, she and her husband both basically were detained over that. And Patrick, I think we keep interrupting you.
Oh, that's okay. No, I was just going to say I had 25 years. I had a front row seat to all the strangeness that you could think of and then some. So I really don't need Google. I just think back on my old days and I have memo books back from 1995 with all the weird stuff that I've been through. And so that's one good part.
I think the moral of the story is that they don't catch you in advance with this stuff, but they will use it against you later. You know, when you're in a cell and they you know, grab your computer and look at your Google search, that's where it's going to bite you.
So make sure you have a good escape plan. This is not
so my advice. Strategy works. It still works. I leave that note in Google and that's going to be part of my search history. That's my, what do you call it?
Your alibi.
That's how I cover myself.
Yeah, that's your alibi, Kevin. Yeah.
Alibi. Thank you, former police officer.
No problem.
All right. Awesome. So as we wrap up, who's up next week?
Oh, next week we've got a really good one. We've got Dennis Lehane coming on. Incredibly talented guy, author of Mystic River, Shutter Island, Gone Baby Gone. His latest book is called Small Mercies and releases April 25th. Dennis Lehane, don't miss that one.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Do you want to write crime stories that are accurate and believable, but lack firsthand experience in law enforcement? Join CopCamp, the Cops and Writers Interactive Conference, and experience what real-life police officers and detectives do through hands-on activities this June 1st through the 4th at the Fox Valley Police Academy in Appleton, Wisconsin. Limited class size of 30 to 40 students ensures an immersive, interactive experience. Attend firearm simulations, drive a squad car, solve mock crime scenes, and use real CSI tools, and more. Register now at premeditatedfiction.com/CopCamp2023 and take your crime writing to the next level.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.